Welcome to episode 289 of After the Credits. I am your co-host, Maureen Antunes. I'm joined today by special co-host.
Hi, I'm Melissa McDowell.
Rejoining us. It's been a while since you've been on the show. Has it been since Viv?
It has been since possibly since the top 10 episode. I think that's one. Yeah. Man. Top 10. So sooner than Viv, but.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Oh man. That feels like a lifetime ago at this point.
I know. 2019 seems like the glory old days, right?
It sure does. And, you know, I keep looking at the news and I'm like, people, what are we doing? We're messing it all up. All that hard work we did.
It's true. The numbers are starting to look scary again, but.
Yeah, I know. Okay, but let's not talk about that. Let's talk about some fun stuff. Well, hopefully fun stuff. I don't know. we're going to talk some movies and TV today and maybe some more stuff. Who knows? But where do you want to start? Do you want to start with some movies or with some television? Or do you have a preference?
I know you've watched
TV.
Yes. I think the pandemic is messing with my usual viewership. And I feel like all I really want to watch lately is garbage television. I have a few movies that I've watched, I guess.
Let's start with the movies then.
Okay. So this morning I tried to get like one decent movie in before recording today, just so I'd have like one good thing to talk about. But I watched the Go-Go's documentary, which was fantastic.
Oh yeah. I watched that one too. I really, really enjoyed it. But I mean, I think I was predisposed to like it. His Dan is a big, big, big Go-Go's fan. So as soon as I told him we had that to watch, he's like, oh yeah, let's watch that. It was fantastic.
So last night I'd watched I Am Divine, the sort of biography documentary about Divine that's on Netflix right now. And so I'm kind of in my head comparing and contrasting the two documentaries, because in some ways they're similar, because they're all like talking head interviews of people about, you know, a career trajectory. In one case, Divine's, in another case, the Go-Go's. But the Go-Go's documentary was just so much more dynamic and vibrant and exciting and interesting than the Divine documentary was, which is really sad, I think, for the Divine documentary, not for the Go-Go's documentary, obviously. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I loved the Go-Go's documentary. I thought it was really interesting, like how kind of careful they were about the band breakup. Like they didn't lie about anything, but they certainly didn't go into detail. And you could tell that that's because they've now gotten back together. So they have like a vested stake in it looking pretty cordial between them all, I guess.
I agree. And I mean, I think one of the things that, and you hit on it, I think one of the things that I really appreciated about it is that they didn't lie about anything. They didn't like purposefully, you know, sweep anything under the rug. There was clearly bad blood when the band did break up, and there was clearly some infighting, and that's never hidden, though, like you say, it's never really highlighted either, but it's clearly there. I really appreciated that a lot. I mean, and it's really great to see. What I really, really enjoyed about it is that just the way that they talk about working together and finding themselves and this energy of women helping women. And one of the things that really struck me, and I mean, the Go-Go's have been around since the, you know, the 80s, I've been listening to them forever. It never, ever, ever in my mind, until the music started in the documentary, I'm like, wow, there's a lot of punk and ska sounds to this. I had never picked up on that, like ever in my life up until that point. I was like, okay, well, I've obviously clearly never really paid much attention to it.
Yeah, I think for me, that was like, I didn't know that much. Like I've learned more about punk music history over the years, but it wasn't something that I was, you know, aware of when I was a tiny child when they were popular. Yeah, I found that interesting. And I think sometimes we forget how far we've come in a short amount of time, because just the notion that they couldn't get signed because they were a girl group, and that like record labels were actually actively telling them, we won't sign you because you're all women and you won't make us any money, was just really, like, I guess I shouldn't be surprised by it, but the fact that that was like 1981 and people were saying that, it's just kind of amazing that, like, how far we've come from that mm-hmm. point
mm-hmm.
in like 40 years.
Yeah, agreed.
But yeah, so Go Ghost documentary, two thumbs up, highly enjoyed it, thought it was fantastic. I the story that I am really interested in, though, is how did they get back together? Because clearly there was so much bad blood when they broke up. And it's kind of like the cynic in me is like, oh, well, you know, they're cashing in on the nostalgia craze. Like, all these bands are getting back together and going on tour because it's the only way they can make money anymore. Mm-hmm. So like, is that all that's there? Or, you know, like, part of me was hoping that there was something kind of more to it than that. But I fear that that's basically all that's there.
Well, I think that you're right. I think in part that has something to do with it. But I mean, a lot of the other bands that get together never create any new music. They're literally just touring off of the material that everybody knows.
That is true.
And the Go-Go's are actively creating new content and new music. So I think there might be something else there as well, in addition to that. But I don't doubt that, you know, money is one of the driving factors for sure.
Yeah. So I watched those two documentaries. And then I also watched First Cow, which was just completely in love with.
Yeah, we had a little fangirl session on that last time we talked.
it's just such a phenomenally well-told story of a friendship. And also the cow is great. And I recently read this really fantastic interview where it was Bong Joon-ho interviewing Kelly Reichardt.
Yes.
And they're adorable. Like, their mutual admiration fest is just one of the cutest things ever. And Kelly was inviting Bong to come down to Oregon to, like, go for hikes with her and Todd Haynes. And I was like, how do I get in on this hike situation? Because the idea of hanging out with those three filmmakers is like, I mean, I don't even need to say anything. I just want to walk behind them and listen.
You know, I thought the same thing. I watched that. I can't remember if I guess I read it. I don't remember now what it was, but I thought it was fantastic as well. And one of the things, it's funny because you mentioned the cow, and one of the things she talks about is finding the perfect cow, which I thought was really, really humorous. We'll link to that that interview. It's a really great conversation.
Yeah, she just picked the prettiest cow.
Yeah.
She is a very pretty cow. I think she did well.
I agree.
And I'm amazed that that cow didn't freak out when she was on that raft thing, because you would think that that's not a natural state for a cow. So it's a good thing that she seemed so blasé about the whole thing.
Yeah.
And then, what else have I watched? I rewatched In the Mood for Love, because I was feeling somewhat melancholy, and I felt like that was the perfect film to watch, you know, when you're already feeling a bit melancholy. Maybe it's not the perfect film to watch when you're already feeling a bit melancholy. I don't know. But it's gorgeous, and I'm in love with Tony Leung and Maggie Cheung. The two of them together are just amazing. And that's like my very short list of movies I've watched recently. It's a really sad list.
Well, I'll try to power through some of mine. I have quite a few. I didn't actually realize there were that many until I wrote them all down. But I finally caught up with Greyhound, which is on Apple TV Plus. This is the Tom Hanks World War II movie that was originally going to get a theatrical release, and then Apple picked it up. And it's decent. Like, the effects are really great. It's Tom Hanks plays the captain of a military ship that's, I guess, escorting I don't know what across the water, and they're basically in this area where the plane, it's too far for the planes to fly over, so there's this dead area in the middle of the ocean where they're basically open to the U-boats, and it's really, really good. It's very short, less than 90 minutes long, just under 90 minutes long, and it's super intense for basically the entire running time, and then at the end it kind of like dies a little bit, but then there's no really clear way to end a movie like that unless you're clearing out in like all out like battle, and it never comes to that. It's quite good. I really enjoyed it, and I'd recommend it. Radioactive. This is the the Marie Curie biopic that Marjane Satrapi directed, which is also streaming on Amazon.
It's not
no.
Great.
No.
Oh, I wanted Marjane to have a great outing as a director. No. Well,
she did The Voices a few years back, which is really, really good. And I'd really recommend that. This one is, the performances are really great. Like Rosamund Pike and Sam Riley are both fantastic as the Curies. It really covers all of Marie Curie's life, sort of starting from when she landed in France. It actually starts quite a bit later when she's basically trying to get a seat on one of the big medical boards, I guess, in Paris. And of course she can't because she's a woman. And the performances are really great. And for the most part, the movie is okay, but it loses a lot of steam constantly because they try to do this thing where they intercut kind of like modern day nuclear disasters and how like nuclear fission has been used poorly by humanity. And kind of like the effect is supposed to be that Marie Curie would be so upset that her discovery would be used for all this death and destruction. And it doesn't really work. And if nothing, it actually, I think, deflates a lot of the energy that the movie builds. So I was really disappointed by that. So it's not it's not the performances that are to blame. It's the editing is just really clunky. And overall, it really doesn't work for the film. I found that it really lost a lot of energy. So I was really disappointed by that, unfortunately. It's not one that I would really recommend. I also watched, finally, like it feels like 3 years later, but I think it came out last year. Gemini Man, Ang Lee's the dual character thing. And I had totally left this one for, you know, later because basically everybody panned it and nobody said it was any good. And I was kind of disappointed because I actually really enjoyed it. I thought it was pretty well done. I mean, I can understand that people had some issues with the technicality of it, of the fact that it had like a higher frame rate and whatever else, and maybe it didn't look good. Like, I don't know. On Amazon, it looks fine. I have no clue, right? To me, it looks the same. The facial matching thing that Weta did is spectacular. Like, it's groundbreaking work and it looks amazing. And honestly, it's just really enjoyable action movie. I don't know. Will Smith is really compelling. What can I say? So I don't know. I thought it was okay. I think it's worth checking out is basically what I came out with. Last episode, Bill had recommended Be Water. This is Bao Nguyen's documentary on Bruce Lee, which is part of the ESPN's 30 for 30, the new season. So I went digging around for it, and I found it on demand through Shaw. So if you have any sort of like sports package, you probably have access to this free of charge through your cable provider. And it's really, really worth checking out. It's a really wonderful documentary about Bruce Lee and his legacy. And one of the things that I found really interesting is how the film is actually built, because you don't actually see, unlike your typical documentary where you get a lot of talking heads intercut with images and documentary footage and whatever else, you see none of the speakers through any of the film until the very, very end. And there's something really mesmerizing about seeing, like, hearing these people talking about Bruce Lee and his legacy and seeing the footage and seeing the stills, but not actually like breaking that sort of trance with the talking head. That's super effective, I thought. It's highly recommended. I really, really enjoyed it. I thought it was really, really good.
I wish like the Cinematheque is doing a retrospective of like Bruce Lee's films right now, because I think a whole bunch of them were just recently restored. Mm-hmm. And I'm still not at the point where I want to go to the theater, but it makes me sad, because if I did, I would totally be there for that series.
Yeah. And if I'm not mistaken, I think Bill might have mentioned that there's a new Criterion package of Bruce Lee films. I think I'll have to look. If there is, I'll put it in the show notes. But it's, the documentary is really good. I quite enjoyed it. I watched You Don't Know Me. This is Jeffrey McHale's documentary on Showgirls. And let me tell you, it is so good. So you don't even need to like Showgirls. You don't even have to have seen Showgirls, though it would help. It is such an engaging documentary and such an amazing, well-researched look at the failure, I guess, that was Showgirls. But more than that, I think it really gives you a really fascinating look at Paul Verhoeven and his work. I mean, I've seen quite a bit of his films, quite a few of his films, and I'd never kind of picked up on the common themes that run through a lot of them until you see them, the clips all together, and you're like, oh, there's definitely a theme here. And everything just kind of conflated itself when it came to Showgirls. It's a really fascinating documentary. I highly recommend checking it out. Have you seen this one?
No, I haven't. But I do. I like I can never pronounce his name properly. Verhoeven.
I don't know. I say Verhoeven.
Verhoeven. Anyway, I love his films because they're always sort of like tongue in cheek satirical, and I appreciate that. I mean, Elle was the one that I had the hardest time with, but even that, it was a film that really made me think a lot. And that film stayed with me for a while after. I kind of had hoped that it wouldn't, but it did. Showgirls is hilarious. He did start Ship Troopers too, right?
Yes, he did.
And RoboCop, obviously, yeah. Of course. Yeah. Like all of those are brilliant. I should totally check that out.
Yeah, it's definitely worth, I think it's one that's definitely worth searching out. It's a really, really fascinating, just hugely entertaining documentary.
Does he get into poor Elizabeth Berkley and her complete loss of career after that film?
Yeah. Yeah, there is a little bit of that and how she eventually came back around to appreciate the film. I think, you know, in part, it's also an interesting snapshot of the time, right? I mean, you hear it a lot. Especially now when we're looking back sort of, you know, 20 years ago and what happened. And I mean, this seems to be the truth with a lot of kind of the sensationalism that came out just as we started getting into the internet age, this like 24-hour news cycle situation that we're in now that we've been living in for a long time. I think that there were quite a few women that kind of got caught in that weird few years that really suffered badly, not for any fault of their own, really. It was just, I mean, if it had happened at any other time, it probably would have been something you sweep under the rug after, you know, your 50 minutes of fame. But they sort of became infamous because of it. And I think Elizabeth Berkley certainly fell into that category. But I also think that in part of it, and one of the things that Mikhail goes into is how just the marketing machine and how everybody took the movie, including the filmmakers and the creators, took the movie so seriously. And then it came out and everybody panned it. And then everybody kind of turned their back on it saying, oh, well, we always intended it to be this joke. And poor Elizabeth Berkley is out there promoting it. I mean, the director can hide behind it, but she can't. Like, she's in all the marketing, she's out there literally all over the place. And the movie is there with her at the front to push it. So I think that she really, I think it was poor Elizabeth Berkley is what I'm trying to get at. And yeah, they do get into a little bit of that and it's really interesting. That's why I think that the documentary is really fantastic. It really does cover kind of all of the aspects and deep dives into this movie in a way that, I never thought I would want to see. And now that I've seen it, I'm like, this is amazing. Let's do this for a bunch of movies. I really enjoyed it. I highly recommend checking it out. It's a good one. Dave Frankel's The Rental, which was a big buzz when it came out, I guess a couple of weeks ago now, with Alison Brie and Dan Stevens, about a group of friends that rent an Airbnb, and things go sideways really quickly. It's solid. I thought it was really enjoyable. I really like Dan Stevens as kind of an asshole bad guy. We should do more of these. So
I like the other guy who's in that, the one from Shameless, plays Lip on Shameless. I can't remember his name.
Jeremy Allen White.
Yes. I love him.
Yeah, I don't watch Seamless, so I don't know him from anywhere else. Really, the only two characters I recognize were Dave Franco and Alison Brie, because we also watch Glow, which I really like and would highly recommend. Mm-hmm. But I thought it was good. I mean, I don't know if it was like sensational. It really, I think it tapped into a bit of the zeitgeist, which I because I don't do a lot of vacation rentals. I don't. It's not something that I can relate to in any sort of way, but I did enjoy it for what it is. You know, I thought it was a fairly slight little horror movie, and it's okay. I mean, I don't know. It's not the best thing I've seen all year. Not the worst. Just is what it is. Just picked up a lot of steam as it was as it was opening. The rhythm section. This is Reed Morano's movie from, I want to say, last Christmas with Blake Lively and Jude Law. It's based on a book by Mark Brunell, which I tried to read and couldn't get through. It was just absolutely, for me, it was terrible. It was just so not my cup of tea. And I know the movie did not do particularly well, but I really enjoyed it. I thought it was pretty good. I think Blake Lively makes a fairly believable action star, and Jude Law kicks ass. So I say see it. I thought it was pretty decent. I finally caught up with Color Out of Space, which is now streaming on Netflix. And holy shit, somebody kicked my ass. What had I been waiting for? It's so good.
I saw it at the Rio. It was like a midnight showing and the theater was packed. And I kind of think that's really the only way I could have watched that film. I don't think I would want to watch it at home by myself in my apartment, to be honest.
Oh, dude, it plays so well, though. So, like, Dan was basically asleep the entire time we watched it, but I loved every single second of it. I think I've waited because, in part, you know, I mean, it's Nick Cage, and he tends to be fairly hammy, but I don't know, man. Something about this movie just works. I don't know. There's some magic here.
He's not fairly hammy in this film. He is, like, over the top hammy in this
film. Oh, he totally is. He totally is. But that's one of the reasons why I kind of didn't jump into it right away, because I find that generally those performances don't really work for me. Sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. And, I mean, I haven't seen enough of Richard Stanley, and I'm not as familiar with him as maybe some other people are. So, he wasn't an initial, like, a must-see for me right off the bat. So I was kind of like, I'll get to it eventually. And then I saw it, and I was like, holy shit, this thing is amazing.
I'll tell you, my absolute favorite thing about that movie is the one scene where Nicolas Cage is watching a Marlon Brando movie on TV. And I was like, Richard Stanley, you fucking genius. I love you. Because, like, you know the whole story behind the island of Dr. Moreau. And so I just thought it was, like, absolutely brilliant that he threw in that, like, little tiny clip of Brando into this film.
Agreed. I thought it was beautiful and really creepy and really smart. And yeah, I'd want a Blu-ray of this with all the extras that anybody can throw out there. So Arrow Video, get on it. Just saying. Okay, so I was Lorena Bobbitt. This is a Lifetime movie. Okay, for the record. So it's a Lifetime movie, but it's directed by the Nishka Esterhazy, who's a director I really, really like. Mm-hmm. She's a Canadian director who did Blackfield and Level 16. I'm a big fan of her. So when I saw that she was doing a Lifetime movie, I'm like, okay, well, I'm going to have to dig this up. And not surprising, it's better than your average Lifetime movie. And it's also really interesting because it's in part also a biopic, also a biography, because they're in between these dramatic reenactments of what happened. You actually get Lorena Bobbitt, the real Lorena Bobbitt, now talking about what happened and how she experienced the events as they unfolded. It's a really good watch. I mean, I thought it was a really good watch, and I would recommend it for sure. It's worth seeking out if you can get your hands on, if you have Lifetime and it's on demand somewhere. I think it's worth checking out. She's one of these other people that kind of got, you know, the 15 minutes of fame were really, really overblown. Now she's become this icon, but the story of how and why she did what she did, I think often gets lost in the mix. And when you start to see some of the details of what happened after she actually cut off her husband's penis and threw it out the window, because that's like the log line, but the stuff that goes with that is really unfortunate and really sad. And to think that she had to resort to that to get to basically save herself is really, really shameful and really, really sad. Tying in a little bit to the Go-Go's is High Note. Nisha Granada's new film, she directed Late Night a couple of years ago, or last year, I think it was. And this one stars Tracee Ellis Ross and Dakota Johnson. And Dakota Johnson plays a personal assistant to Tracee Ellis Ross, who plays this massive R&B superstar, who is, I guess, maybe like a Diana Ross character. So she's, you know, 40 something and she's a Black woman and she's like world renowned, but she hasn't really put out any new music or anything that's kind of outside of her comfort zone in a number of years. And Dakota Johnson thinks that, you know, she has another life. She can put out another album. That's what the fans want to see. And, you know, you mentioned how it's shocking that the Go-Go's, that only happened like 20 years ago or 30 years ago, where, you know, the industry was telling them that you couldn't have an all-female group making it anywhere. And one of the things that comes up in this movie, which is, you know, your fairly standard, like dramatic fare. I mean, I really enjoyed it. The performances are quite good, but the movie itself is fairly standard. But one of the things that really comes through is there's this constant harping that, you know, there aren't a lot of women over 40 who have number one hits. And there's a reason for that. And then you add in the fact that she's a Black woman, and that even makes things more difficult. So some of the insights that it provides into like the music industry are really, really, really fascinating. But really, it's a fairly mediocre drama, but I really liked it. I thought it was pretty well done, and the chemistry between Ross and Dakota Johnson is really great.
I'm not a huge fan of Dakota Johnson, to be honest. I mean, I thought she did really good work in Suspiria, but other than that, I've never been all that impressed with her.
Yeah, she has a very like internal sort of performance style, and it doesn't always come through. I thought she was pretty good here, but again, the movie is pretty mediocre overall.
Right.
It just has some interesting little tidbits sort of throughout. I think Tracee Ellis Ross is a real star here. Even though the movie is really about Dakota Johnson, like she's the central driving force behind the film, Ross steals it. Like she's fantastic.
What's a movie about a Black singer without the white savior?
Well, this is it, right? And this is the other sort of concern about it that I have, which is why I don't want to like raise it too much. But I did enjoy it. I needed a little bit of a pick-me-up and something a little lighter fare, and this totally fit the bill for me. It was, you know, innocuous. It was pretty good. Tito and the Birds, which is a Brazilian animated film, which is quite dark. It's about this little boy whose father become so obsessed with birds who he thinks are like gonna save the world that he leaves his family in order to work on this project that he has with birds. And so the kid grows up without a dad. And it kind of gets at, you know, this kid all of a sudden starts getting involved with the idea of birds being saviors and being communicators and saving the world. Now he's sharing this thing with his dad who he's estranged from. It's a really, really lovely story, but it's really, really, really dark. It's really not for kids as far as I'm concerned. I'd be very hard pressed to share this with like one of my younger nieces. I think it's really for like a little bit older kids, but it's absolutely beautiful. And it's now available, I think, on VOD and streaming. So it's one worth checking out. It's pretty good. The Beyond. This one came up on my Amazon, like, you might enjoy this list. And it sounded pretty basic, but the visuals for the trailer looked amazing, so I had to check it out. So the basic concept is they find, like, these things start showing up on Earth. They find this, at the same time, they find this, like, black hole. They're going to send something to explore. So they decide that they're not going to send humans. They're going to send this sort of mix of humans and hybrids. So they build these like computer robot bodies, and they're going to put people's brains into the bodies to make them like conscious. There is a reason for this. I'm not going to get into the details of to why, because it's pretty convoluted. But god damn it, this movie is really engaging. I loved it. I thought it was fantastic. I love the way that it's basically like there's no stars here, but it's shot like almost like a documentary. Actually, not like, it is shot like a documentary. So it has that going for it as well. And it looks superb. And the visual effects are like fucking mind blowing. I highly recommend checking it out if you're into like sort of like sci-fi, like big idea movies. This is definitely up there. It's one of the better ones I've seen of late. I really enjoyed it. And I can't believe it. I think it's a few years old now. And the director, Harsraf Dulul, I think he's English. And he is a visual effects artist. And it's clearly noted in the level of the visual effects in the movie. I mean, they're so spectacular.
I've often wondered why more genre filmmakers don't do documentary style. Because I think like it's a bare bones way of filming. It's quite forgiving in terms of the style. And it also really pushes that whole realistic element of a very genre type storytelling. It seems like such a smart thing to do to me.
I agree. I think with something like this, which is clearly much lower budget, the issue that comes up is you have to have like a really, really great cast of like really solid actors to really pull off that like real, you know, and that sometimes falls. And if you miss that boat, the whole thing just falls apart. One of the things that really impressed me here is just how good the actors are. Cause it really, like for a while, it really does feel like a documentary. And then you remember, oh yeah, this is not a documentary. This shit isn't really happening. But it's so effective. I wish more people would see this movie. It's really good. I really enjoyed it. So I highly recommend it. It's called The Beyond. Don't pass over it when you next log into your Amazon account. Just check it out. It's worth it. I swear to God.
Okay, the poster, noted.
Yeah, because the poster is just so like, oh, whatever. And then you watch the movie and you're like, holy shit, this thing is amazing. So I highly recommend that one. 1,000 Cuts. This is Ramona Diaz's documentary about Maria Ressa, who's the Filipino journalist that President Duterte has, I think, now arrested and thrown into prison. It's a fantastic documentary. Super, super highly recommend it. It's a really insightful look, not only at the current state of the Philippines, but they also really dig deep into social media and how companies kind of use a country like the Philippines to sort of pre-test their approaches. And then they, whatever works and whatever doesn't work, if it works, they will roll it out to other nations, including the US. So they use the Philippines as sort of a testing ground because so much of the country is connected and very technically like computer literate. But the parallels and the commonalities that Diaz makes between, and that actually Maria Ressa makes between, you know, what's happening in the Philippines and what's happening in like the US is really eye-opening. It's a really fantastic documentary. I highly recommend checking it out. It's called 1,000 Cuts.
And where did you find that one?
It was one of the Movie of the Week selections for the Alliance of Women Film Journalists. Yes. So it's currently available streaming on demand. So it's definitely worth the look for sure. And then the last one that I want to mention is She Dies Tomorrow, which is Amy Simes' new movie or first film, I guess, which stars Caitlin Scheel, who should be in every movie in the universe because she's amazing. I don't get it. Like, straight up, I don't fully understand what happened in this movie. She, you know, it's about a woman who buys a house, becomes obsessed, thinks she's like starts to believe that she's actually going to die tomorrow. And then that starts to spread to other people that she talks to. So she like infects a friend of hers who also starts to believe she's going to die tomorrow. It's weird, but it's really beautiful and super creepy. And the performances are outstanding. And some of the cameos in this movie are amazing. I'll just leave it at that. It's good. It's a good one. Not for everybody, but it's a good one.
Yeah, I've been seeing like more buzz around that on like Letterboxd and Twitter and stuff, but I haven't picked it up yet.
Yeah, it's a good one. It's a bit weird, but I think you would appreciate it.
I like weird. You know me.
It's a good one. It's a good one. And that's it. Those are all the movies I have. That's worth enough. What do you got for TV? I know you have TV.
Yes.
Talk about the soft line.
TV. Okay. So I like really the pandemic has just, I don't know what it's doing to my brain, but I only want to watch really garbage TV. So first of all, I've watched, I think, all 10 seasons of Ink Master that are available on Amazon. that show is awful. Like it's objectively awful. But I can't stop watching it. I don't even have any tattoos. But I'm obsessed with that show and I'm slightly obsessed with Chris Nunez. Chris, if you're watching, call me. So starting there and then more white trash tattooed people, Sons of Anarchy, all 7 seasons, had to binge that.
Okay. I take offense to that because I actually think Sons of Anarchy is a really, really great show.
It is, but I mean, it's like, it's not a progressive show, let's say. So, I mean, there's that. It's there's a lot of misogyny in that show. It's not great on race issues. It's problematic, but as I said, I'm just really into trash television right now. I just want to watch crap and not fit the bill. And Charlie Hunnam is a very attractive man.
Yeah, he calls to us, doesn't he?
Even when he's speaking in sort of a terrible American accent, he's still a very attractive man. And I feel slightly redeemed in the fact, like, even though it's not a progressive show, I feel like watching it, I'm supporting Ron Perlman, who is an incredibly progressive man and who's done all kinds of wonderful things, like offer to fist fight Ted Cruz and calls out the president of the United States on a daily basis on Twitter. So maybe that's the redeeming feature. I don't know.
Totally. I mean.
So then on the flip side of that, I've been watching a lot of RuPaul's Drag Race. So RuPaul's Drag Race All Stars. And I love Shea Coulee. Sorry if this is spoilery, but honestly, Jujubee is one of my favorite Drag Race contestants of all time. And she's now been on the show 3 times and has not won. And I find that sad, but I love her. And also watching Canada's Drag Race and watching Queer Eye. So I'm watching a lot of queer mental health related content is how I feel. Like it's not directly mental health content, but I feel like the way that they talk about self-acceptance and self-love on those shows definitely contributes to my mental health, which is why I really enjoy those shows.
Self-care, man. Self-care. Yeah.
And then like Bill Harris, I am still hate watching the 100. It is awful. It has been awful for many seasons now, but I feel like I have to play this card to the end.
I'm going to say, get off my lawn. That's how I feel about you guys and your hate watching. I have actually not watched the last, because I think there was a weird gap there. Like they didn't release a couple of episodes for like 2 or 3 weeks. I don't know how much. And I know that there's a new episode, but I haven't watched it yet because I want to be able to enjoy it. And I have been quite busy. So it's on my list of things to watch when I have some downtime so I can get back into the swing of things. But
well, good luck enjoying it. I've given up enjoying that show. I now like literally just hate watching it and feeling really bad for the cast because I actually really enjoy the cast of that show. And it's so convoluted and makes absolutely no sense. To be fair, it has not made a lot of sense for the last probably few seasons, but
I can go with that. I mean, I will agree that it has gotten quite convoluted. One of the things that I still enjoy about it though is I mean, overall, I like the weird sort of wackiness of the story. I'm totally okay with buying into that. But I really just like the cast and I like a lot of the characters and I just want them to do well. And that's really not a reason to support a show, but it's why I keep watching it and I keep enjoying it. So, and I have no issues with like really weird, makes no sense TV. I'm fine with that.
I like weird. I prefer when it sort of makes some amount of sense. But
oh yeah, it's always better when it makes sense, but you know, whatever.
Well, yeah, and I'm the other thing is I'm not sure, you know, this is what season is this even?
Six or seven?
Seven seasons. I mean, there's only so many times you can sort of retell this story of survival through killing other people and what does that do to us? Like,
and you know, the funny part is that I gave up on The Walking Dead for exactly that reason, because every season you could read the writing on the wall. Like by the time they got to like the middle of the season, they were already starting to put the ball into play to leave and end up somewhere else where the whole thing would repeat itself. Mm-hmm. And it just got so boring and convoluted that I was like, fuck this, I'm not watching this anymore. And we stopped watching The Walking Dead. Like, I don't even know how many seasons ago now, but I'm sure I can tune in tomorrow and it'll be like a soap opera. It'll be exactly where I left off and I'll know exactly what's going on.
Well, except that you won't know who anybody is anymore because almost all of the good actors have left the show.
Yeah, but you know, but with the 100, for whatever reason, I don't mind like watching it. And I think in part it's because of the actors and the relationships that they've managed to develop over the seasons. And yeah, sometimes like, a lot of the time, admittedly, especially in the last few seasons, things have gotten super convoluted and complicated. And for the first, like for like a good part chunk of this season, I was like, oh, what the hell is going on? And what universe are we in? And what is going, like, really, how are these things related? And I'm still watching. So, hey, something about it is working for me. I don't know. I can't really put my finger exactly on what it is.
I can't say anything about it is working for me, but I am still watching it. And I don't know if this is just because, you know, like it films here. It gives a lot of people jobs here. There's a lot of really great local actors who are on the show who I'm very happy for them that they've had this kind of run on any kind of series. So I think that is really terrific. And I hope it means good things for their careers going forward. Also, this season, the other disappointing thing about this season is that I don't know what happened, but there's been no Bob Morley on the show for like a while.
Yeah, apparently he does come back in the later part of the season because I did see some sort of spoiler alert, or maybe somebody was just lying because, like I say, I haven't watched the last episode, so I don't know what's going on there either.
Yeah, so that's kind of because I like Bob Morley, and so it's been weird not having him on the show much this season.
So the real question is, will you watch the spinoff?
No. Because if that like prequel episode was supposed to be selling me on the new show, I have like zero interest in it.
Mm. Okay. Any other TV?
No, I mean, it's kind of, Umbrella Academy, which is phenomenal. I love Umbrella Academy.
I just started watching season one. I'm a little behind.
So part of it is because I love Robert. Is it Meehan?
Yep.
Oh, yes. Yes, Klaus. Anyway, he is phenomenal. He's so great in that. I loved him in The Misfits too, and I adore him in Umbrella Academy. Because there's no in The Misfits, there was like a little bit of a meanness underneath his humor, and in Umbrella Academy, there's not a mean bone in Klaus's body. I feel like.
I really like Tom Hopper a lot, so I'm really happy to watch anything that he's in at this point.
Yeah, he's great. Ellen Page, always good. And I think this second season was really interesting. And like, talk about a show where you can have like some really convoluted storyline stuff happening. And in their case, it's like a bunch of different timelines. Their show still makes sense. So yeah, like it's, you can follow it. There's still complex things happening. There's still like the whole intellectual debate around time travel and what it would mean to go back to other times and what would happen if you ran into yourself. And like all of that kind of stuff still plays out in Umbrella Academy, but I think they do it in a really sort of fun way. And I love Five. Like, I just love this, I love his personality in that tiny human package. I love that. It's great. He's such a great character.
Everybody said I didn't watch it, so I did add the show to my watch list. And I think I'm like 4 episodes into season 1. So that's definitely something that I'm going to continue to watch.
You know, honestly, when I first started watching season 1, I was like not sure about it. And then it got to a point where I was like, okay, well, I'm invested, so I'll keep going. Season 2, I had like none of those thoughts at all. It was just like straight up right from episode 1, I was completely in.
Yeah, and everybody has said the same thing. The common agreement is that season 2 is like head and shoulders above season 1. But I figure I'd start from the beginning. And so far, I'm enjoying what I've seen so far.
Mm-hmm. And then also the other television show that I watched, which I'm pretty sure we have in common, is Warrior Nun, which I completely binged the crap out of.
And oh, shit, that show, man.
That show, again, like, is it like... Is this golden age of television material? No. Is it incredibly entertaining and super fun to watch? Yes.
Oh, it's amazing. I freaking love this show from like the get-go. Mind you had me at Warrior Nun. a bunch of nun warriors. There's like this crazy like secret society. There's religious mythology and iconography. And then, you know, you dig a little deeper and it just looks amazing. It's all shot in Spain, features like a cast of international actors, most of whom you've never seen before. It just, for me, it really works. I was in there like a dirty shirt. I am such a fan of the show. Oh my God.
It is fun. It reminds me a lot of Buffy, like not necessarily every like plot points, et cetera, but the feel of it feels very much like Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Yeah. And I can't make that comparison because I never was a Buffy fan. That show came out in a period where like, it just was not the kind of thing that I would watch. And by the time that I was kind of into that kind of show and I went back to try to watch Buffy, I found it so dated and hard to get into that I never got past like the 3rd episode. And so to this day, I've only maybe seen, you know, a handful of Buffy episodes and maybe only one that I really, really liked. I think it's called Hush because that's the only one that I really, really loved. But, you know, I could never really get into the whole fandom of Buffy. So I don't have that to go by. But what I can say is I thought the show was fabulous fun and I cannot wait for season 2. Bring it on.
Yeah, I thought it was hilarious. And you're right. Honestly, a big selling point for me was the Southern Spanish locations because, I mean, it's just a gorgeous part of the world. So never a bad thing watching that.
No, and I'll pimp myself here. I had the opportunity to talk to Simon Barry earlier in the week and totally fangirl over the show. So I'll link to that when that episode of the other podcast that I do is live because it was a lot of fun to talk to him about, and not just Warrior Nun, but we talked a little bit about Continuum as well. So it was a little bit surreal, to be totally honest, because I tried very hard not to go total fangirl on him, and it was hard. But I think I succeeded.
I also think it's really fascinating because there were a lot of female directors on Warrior Nun as well, which I really appreciated. Mm-hmm. And Agnieszka Smoczyńska, who's a Polish director who did The Lure and Fugue. I think she's brilliant. And she did like 2 episodes of this show. And I really hope someone gives her money to make another movie soon because I think she's incredibly talented and I want to see more of her stuff.
Agreed, 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 agreed. All of that plus. Anything else for you?
No, that's on my TV.
I haven't watched a whole lot either. I kind of binged Warrior Nun and then I kind of gave up on life, but no, I'm kidding. I think I mentioned it at the end of the last show. I powered through Sanditon, which is... the ITV/BBC co-production of Jane Austen's unfinished novel, created, I guess, and adapted by Andrew Davies, who's kind of like the master of this stuff. I know Bill made some comment about, you know, you get an old white guy to adapt Jane Austen, but truth be told, he's really good at it. So I have no issues with that, no qualms about it. Rose Williams and Theo James are super charming. And the show is, you know, it's very Jane Austen. It's the plots that you're familiar with and kind of the language that you're familiar with. And it does have some things that are a little more updated that come through. And really, it's just this lush period piece that's, I really enjoyed it. I watched it over like a period of 2 or 3 days. It was a nice reprise from reality, so I recommend that one. I finally finished the second half of The Witcher. I watched about half the show, and then for whatever reason got sidetracked, probably because it was such another convoluted mess. And then I'm like, okay, it keeps nagging at me to watch this. It's on my watch list. Continue watching for Marina. I'm like, fine, I'll rewatch it. And you know what? It's fun. I mean, I don't really know what to say about it because it is kind of a mess. It certainly makes, having read the book that it's based on, I can see the difficulty of adapting that universe to the screen, because the book is basically a series of short stories, sort like adventure tales of The Witcher. And, you know, like he's like each chapter is kind of like another adventure. So it's not really a cohesive story, and they build the universe through these various tales. So it feels very disconnected, and the show suffers from a little bit of that. But the fact that they managed to get like one through storyline of it, I thought was really, really good. And honestly, I really enjoyed it. It's nice to see Henry Cavill whenever you want. And Anya Chalotra, who plays Jennifer, is freaking fantastic. I want to see more of her and other things because she is so, so good here.
I really liked her too. I agree that the show is like super convoluted. It was like another one of those things where I watched the first two episodes and I was like, I'm not going to stay with this. But various people told me that I should. And sort of when everything plays out at the end and you can kind of see how it all came together, that is actually interesting.
Mm-hmm, I agree.
But it's hard to not give up before you get there. And I love Henry Cavill too, but that wig is awful. Like, couldn't they have spent more money for a better wig?
Oh yeah, dude. This is a common complaint. I can't remember. I don't know where I saw it, but there was a thread or something somewhere about how we need to do something about wigs and CGI hair because it's always so bad. And I am fully behind this. Like, we need to figure this shit out. We are in 2020. VFX have come a long way. Come on, people. We can.
But I will say, like, those, his fight scenes, like his sword fighting scenes are awesome. Like, fight choreography in that show is really impressive.
A lot of the show is really impressive. The fight choreography is really impressive. The visuals are really impressive. Some of the acting is like super great. Like I really enjoyed it. Like once, if you stick to it, I mean, it's not like you say, it's not like an easy watch, but I don't know. I just let the episodes roll one after the other once I started it up again and it was fine. I did like it, but I really liked the finale and I really like Yennefer. I think she's a fantastic character. Bring her back. Have more. I'm all in. I also watched Brave New World. This is Grant Morrison and Brian Taylor's adaptation of Aldous Huxley's, well, massive novel. I don't know. I guess most people at this point have read it. They read it in high school. They maybe
It was like mandatory high school reading, I think. Yeah.
And for me, it was a book that I really, really liked and that stayed with me over the years. So I was really excited to see an adaptation. This was what Peacock, one of the shows that Peacock, the new streaming platform from, I guess, CBS. Is it CBS or NBC?
NBC, probably. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That they launched with. It stars Alden Ehrenreich and Jessica Brown Findlay and Joseph Morgan and Demi Moore. It's an interesting adaptation. It's been probably a good decade since I read the book, though I have read the book a number of times. And my knee jerk is that it takes quite a few liberties with the source material. The bones of it are strong, but I don't know. It doesn't fully work. I mean, I did watch the whole thing, but I can't say I loved it. I liked bits and pieces of it. But in the end, it wasn't really a home run for me. I don't know why. I can't really put my finger on it. I just don't think that the story fully works. So it did not a very good translation as far as I'm concerned. So I would say probably skip that one. Immigration Nation, which was the big buzz show from last week, which landed on Netflix. And I would say this is probably one of the better things I've seen this year. It plays amazingly well. And it's absolutely fascinating and really powerful. And I want to know all the things about how they got themselves embedded with ICE, because I cannot see for the life of me how anybody in ICE like thought this would be a good idea. Like, it's like, what planet are you living on that you actually think embedding two journalists to tell like the real story is going to look good for ICE? So I've been trying to find those stories and I haven't seen anything. So if anybody knows of a link where there's an interview with the filmmakers about how this all came together, I would love to read it. But yeah, it's anger and upsetting and eye-opening and very sad and really, really effective. And I thought it's a really fantastic documentary. Did you not see this one yet? I'm surprised. I thought
I haven't. It's on my list, but I haven't watched it yet, because like I said, I've been watching garbage television. So yeah. That's definitely not garbage. But yeah, that's definitely on my watch list. And so is the series that Kate Blanchett just did as well about refugee issues in Australia.
Oh, I haven't heard anything about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because she's one of the UNHCR's celebrity ambassadors, right? And so she just produced and she has a role in it as well. It's a story about a woman who has no ID and ends up in one of the detention centers.
Oh, I'm definitely going to check this one out. I will link to it in the show notes. We'll figure
it out. I'm blanking on the name of it right now, which is terrible. But yeah, that is also on Netflix. So I was going to watch both of those, you know, for.
Oh, wait, is this, are you sure? Oh, it's Stateless, it's called.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. This is also, I added it to my watch list, but I added it because I really like Yvonne Strahovski, who is the star of it. And that came up. I didn't actually realize that Kate Blanchett was in it at all. So. Go figure. So yeah, that's another one that looks really good. I didn't realize that's what it was about, but it came up as you may like this. So apparently Netflix knows me pretty well. Who knew? And the last show that I watched is Cursed. This is the Catherine Langford vehicle.
Oh yeah, the King Arthur retelling. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is interesting because I actually picked up this book last year and I haven't gotten around to reading it yet. I have a soft spot for Arthurian legend. It's kind of like it totally in my wheelhouse. And it's something that I've always really loved. And I like new takes on the legend because, I mean, nobody really knows what it is. So, you know, there's lots of room for interpretation. And I really liked this adaptation. It starts off a little bit rocky. And I'm not really sure where they're going to go for the second season because they leave it quite clearly open-ended for a second season. But I really did like kind of the darker tone of it and how it works a little bit within the, like it marries reality with a fantasy because you have the fairy folk that basically she plays the fairy queen. And it's a side of the Arthurian legend that is often like left behind, even though you have the Lady of the Lake and this bloody sword is stuck in a rock. So I don't know. I really liked it. I thought it was great. The visuals are really fantastic. I actually didn't think Gustav Skarsgård was that great as Merlin. He feels a little bit vacant to me, which is weird because he tends to be pretty good. But overall, I really enjoyed the show. And I did not hate watch it. So there's that. Because I know somebody else mentioned it to me. It may have been Bill that mentioned that he was watching it and wasn't really enjoying it, but was watching it regardless. And I actually did really enjoy it. I thought it was pretty well done. And I would definitely watch the second season. So that's it. That's all I've been watching for the last little while, which is a bit.
That's a lot, man.
Yeah. That's it.
My list is short, but it's like multiple seasons. I think that's the thing. Like,
I mean, seven seasons of Sons of Anarchy is quite a time commitment.
Yeah. Yeah. More than the show deserves in one sitting. Anyway, that's.
Oh, man. That's great. So like, have you read anything or do you have any podcasts you want to recommend?
I've been terrible about listening to podcasts too, because I used to do that on walks and then I've been on my bike, so I don't like to wear headphones, obviously, when I'm cycling. But I have been picking up again with a Crackdown podcast, which is Garth Mullen's podcast on the overdose epidemic in the downtown east side, which is really, really brilliantly good. And if you haven't been listening to it, you totally should listen to it. I have this like funny thing too, like where I come to podcasts really late and then I'm always like have this conundrum about, should I start at the beginning and then try to catch up, or do I just start where we're at right now and then hopefully go back to it? Like, what do you do when you come across a podcast that's been out for a while? And
well, I guess it depends on the podcast. Like, because I listen to a variety of podcasts. Some of them are sort of linear, where they're telling one story over a season, and some of them are not, where, you know, they kind of, every episode is its own thing. Mm-hmm. So it totally depends. Like, so for some, where there isn't this through line, which is, you know, every time there's a new episode, it's just a standalone. I'll just watch those. I'll just listen to those, you know, as they go. And then if I have time and I'm looking for something else, I might look back into the archives. But generally speaking, for the most part, I almost never look at the archives because I just don't have time. There's always something new that I want to listen to. But for the shows where like there's actually like a continuing story, I'll always start from episode one, because it's almost, for me, it's like watching TV. Like, if I don't start at the beginning, it's not the full story and I feel like I'm missing something. So, but it totally depends on what kind of podcast it is, for sure.
Yeah, I just find like sometimes with these older ones where I'm going back, like where I'm going back and then trying to catch up, it's like it becomes like a daunting task. Like, oh my God, it's going to take me like 20 hours to get caught up to the present day. And then that, it just feels like a bigger thing. And it's like, well, wait a minute, I'm doing something that's enjoyable. Like, I'm listening to something that I'm, you know, learning something or taking something away from. So it's not like, it's not a chore, but somehow it becomes a chore when I have to do that. I don't know if that makes any sense.
No, it does, but I'm like, I don't listen to I haven't so far listened to any podcasts that have that much of a backstory, like that, that have like 20 episodes, but that are part of like a bigger overall story. Like, all of these shows that I listen to that have that many episodes in the back catalog are all like standalone shows, like Planet Money or like some news current news kind of shows, where you don't really need to listen to last week's episode to know what's going on now. So I'm definitely not in that camp. I don't listen to any podcasts that fit that description. So I can't provide any insight. Sorry.
So yeah, I mean, the podcast that I listen to the most regularly is actually this one. So there you go.
Yay, yes. I've pimped it before, but I feel like I need to mention this podcast every single chance I get, because if you're not listening to it, you're missing out on life. And that would be Throughline, NPR's history podcast, which looks at events in the past to kind of make sense of what's going on in the present. Their description of it is much nicer than mine, but it's a fabulous show. If you're not listening to it, you really need to put this on your rotation, because the shows are always really timely, always really insightful, really well researched, and they're a fantastic sort of history lesson in basically 40 minutes, because the shows are approximately 40 minutes long. And they've just launched a kind of leading up to back to school, because there are teachers that use a lot of their episodes for history classes because they are so good. They are currently running like a little mini curriculum of shows that are specifically designed to be used in classrooms. And the first one that they've done in this kind of new part of the show is on the ADA, which I guess just celebrated 30 years. And that's the, I don't know, Individuals with Disabilities Act or something like that. I don't remember what it's called exactly, but yeah, I highly recommend that show if you're not already listening to it. I cannot recommend it highly enough. Throughline.
Cool. Okay. Well, I'll add that one.
Yeah. I recommend it to everybody. Everybody needs to be listening to Throughline. It's amazing. That's it. That's all I got. Nothing else. I'm still reading the same book. I will get over this. I promise. There is a new Twilight book. So shit is happening, people.
Oh yeah, this is the one that's basically just Twilight over again, but from Edward's perspective. Is that, yeah?
Yes. So there was this thing when Twilight was a really big deal, like a decade ago now. I cannot believe it's been that long. When it was a really big deal, Midnight Sun, what was available of it was leaked somewhere. It ended up online. And no joke, I wasn't continuing to be such a fangirl. I still have my printed copy of the 230-odd pages that was leaked.
That's love. If you're willing to print 239 pages of a thing off the internet, that's love.
I didn't just print it. I downloaded the file and I sent it to the printer. It's printed and bound. I have a problem. I fully admit it. But yeah, so I did read it. It's been a really long time though. So I have no idea if they've made any changes. I'm assuming that it's been edited, but I've ordered it. I'm very much looking forward to delving back into Twilight for a very, very special moment in my life. Yeah.
Well, I've been, so as much as my viewing habits have been like tending towards garbage, my reading habits have been like almost entirely nonfiction through the entire pandemic, which is kind of nuts. But I just read this book called Legends of Vancouver. It's by a woman named E. Pauline Johnson. And this book was published in 1911. And she herself was a Mohawk woman who eventually moved out to this coast. She was a poet and a playwright who traveled to England and performed there and performed all across Canada as a one-woman show, which was quite an unusual thing, particularly for a woman, one, but also for an Indigenous woman, second. And she ended up being friends with Chief Joe Capilano from the Squamish Nation, who told her a lot of stories around landmarks around the city of Vancouver and area. And she wrote a book telling all of these stories. The book's fascinating. Like, it's just really interesting to read these stories. And apparently she's buried in Stanley Park. Like, there's an actual monument with her tomb, which I've never seen. So I feel like I'm going to have to go exploring in Stanley Park and try to find this. But I just found the whole thing fascinating. I mean, the stories themselves are really interesting. Like, it's just interesting to hear this part of where we are in the world. But also just the ethics of this, I also kind of wonder about, because it's definitely my understanding that within First Nations, there are protocols around storytelling, and that stories tend to belong to certain families or to certain clans. And so the fact that this other woman ended up telling these stories and publishing them in a book and, you know, probably making some money off of them, I wonder about that. And I'd really like to find out more about Squamish reaction to this book. And I haven't sort of tracked down any of that criticism yet, but I'm very curious about it. But it's been a really interesting little read. So if you're looking for something and you're just curious about Indigenous stories around the area of Vancouver, it's called Legends of Vancouver.
Wow, that sounds like a totally fascinating read. Thanks so much for that, Melissa. And with that, I think we've come to the end of the show. We've been talking for quite a while. We've talked about lots of stuff today. Thanks so much, Melissa, for joining us. Thank you all for tuning in. Be sure to come on by atcpod.ca for links to all of the stuff that we talked about today. And we will be back with another episode in a couple of weeks. Until next time, we will see you after the credits. opening and closing credits are Arcadia by composer Kevin MacLeod, used under a Creative Commons license. For more information, visit incompetech.com.